apologize in advance. My voice is getting worse. By tomorrow morning, I'll be like Barry White. But yeah, I'm gonna record my Motown album tomorrow, I think. As we continue to unpack this truth about who we are, that we are graciously designed and destined for a glorious good, and as we continue to move through the book of Ephesians, I kind of want to just pull it back tonight and really focus around one idea, and it's built around a contrast. And the question that I have for us at this point in the weekend, now that we're into session three, we're kind of past the halfway point, and we're closing in on kind of the end of our time together, is I want to just contrast the alternative. What is the other option? If not God, then what? What other voice is going to determine our identity? Who is going to tell us who we are and why we exist, if not God? And what I want to focus on tonight is this word that kind of pops up through Ephesians multiple times, but it's the word walk. And what we see in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 15, it says to look carefully how you walk. Keep a close eye on the life that you're living. Look carefully how you walk, not as unwise, but as wise. And that's all I want to do tonight, is I want to show that this gracious destiny and design that God has for us, this glorious good that we're made for, is the wisest way that you can live your life. In fact, Paul goes on to say in verse 16, if you look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise, but as wise, it's how you make the best use of your time. And I don't know of anybody who wants to waste their life, but I know a lot of people who waste their time. We need to look carefully how we walk. We need to examine how we live so that we live and walk wisely, making the best use of our time because the days are evil. Therefore, don't be foolish, but understand what the will of the Lord is. God is not silent. He wants you to know the glorious good that he has created for you, but grace, this grace that gets us through this journey, this grace that sustains us day in and day out, grace is like a cold glass of lemonade. It is sour at first because it speaks to something broken about us, and yet it is so sweet. It is so sweet. It's kind of this strange contrast. And what we see in Ephesians 4, verses 17, all the way through 5:21, is that there are these two ways that we can live our lives. One of them Paul calls wise, and the other he calls foolish. And tonight, I just want you to think about how you want to make use of your life. Do you want to make the best use of your days? Do you want to walk wisely? Because at the beginning of chapter 5, Paul gives us the key to walking wisely. He says to be imitators of God as beloved children. Because you have been brought into the family, imitate, mimic, follow the Father. And then he says this in verse 2. Here's that word again. Walk in love. Walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. I mentioned earlier this morning that Andy Stanley wrote a book called Irresistible. And in that book, he spends a whole chapter looking at the Last Supper, John 13 specifically, that account of the Last Supper. And it is so intriguing to me that Jesus, a law-abiding Jew, Jesus, the fulfillment of the law, Jesus knowing that there were 613 laws in the Old Testament, when he was confronted by a scribe, a teacher of the law, and asked, what is the most important law? Jesus says, the first and most important command is this, that you love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And the second is just like it. It's actually two sides of one coin. The second is like it, that you love your neighbor as yourself. He took all 613 laws of the Old Testament and he brought it down to two. But the night of the Last Supper, Jesus, knowing that his time had come, stripped off his outer garment and washed the feet of his closest friends. And he sits down to share in the celebratory meal with them, but it has a kind of somber tone to it because Jesus is talking as though this is his last night with the group. And then he tells them this, he says, a new command, John 13:34, a new command I give to you. A new command. You know 613 commandments of the Old Testament, and you know the two that I've talked about in my life, my ministry here, but I'm giving you a new command. Love one another. Love one another. Now, we can only know for sure that the 12 were in that room, but there may have been a handful more. I don't know. But Jesus says, this new command I give you, love one another, and by this, all the world will know that you are my disciples. Guys, it is extremely simple. When you're thinking about how to walk wisely, it is extremely simple. Walk in love. What kind of love? As Jesus loved. Walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us. When we say drill and fill with the love of God, and we ask, well, what does that look like? It actually, for Jesus, looked like spilling his blood. He actually gave up his life for the people that he loved. And the scripture says that greater love has none than this, that one lay down his life for his friends. In the greatest act of love, Jesus makes clear what it looks like to be an imitator of him. Why? Why, Jesus? Why, of all the things he could have said that night, he could have given them the Great Commission in that moment, but he didn't. He gave them this new command. Why? He could have told them to do anything. He could have told them to share their faith 100 times a day. He could have told them to live perfectly righteous lives. He could have told them to go and burn down the temple. He could have told them 1,000 different things, but he tells them to love one another as he has loved them. Why does he choose this command? Why does Paul say it's so central for us if we're going to live wisely that we walk in love? It's because love is the most powerful force in the world. It is the single most powerful force in the world. And only love has the power to change a life. Only love has the power to change a life. In fact, all five gifts without love are nothing. In fact, Paul says in another letter that life without love is nothing. All the gifts of the Spirit, all the manifestations, all the right behaviors, all the Christianese, all of it is nothing without love. When I think of that, I can't help but think of the greatest love story that Disney has ever told. Beauty and the Beast. And those of you that know the story know why it is the greatest story of all the Disney love stories. Because in the story of Beauty and the Beast, we see someone whose life is marked by the absence of love, and they become hideous. And all the people around them are negatively influenced by that person's lack of love. There's punishment not just for you when you fail to walk in love, but there's punishment for all of those who are around you. It's why it's so foolish to live outside of love. The absence of love changed and transformed that entire castle. It was under, as the story says, a curse, much like the world we live in, under a curse. And everyone in that castle was waiting for love to arrive. And love came in the form of beauty. Belle, it's what her name means. Beauty arrived. And over time, Beauty saw that the Beast was not hopeless. And she began to realize that her love, her affection, her delight, her enjoyment of him could possibly save his soul. She enters into the castle and she brings a love that was foreign to him, and she overwhelms the Beast with her love. She shows grace upon grace. She is rich in mercy. There is immeasurable grace and kindness that she displays to him. And in my favorite scene of the cartoon, the new one's kind of weird with, I mean, the Beast is ferocious. But my favorite scene in the cartoon is when that last petal drops and she professes her love for the Beast, and it seems as though it was just too late. And then what happens? Through his hand, a beam of light breaks through. And then his foot. And then his chest. And what had been locked beneath this hideous, ferocious exterior begins to be penetrated by this internal light, the light that love had given. It's what Paul says, if we will walk in love, this is verse 2, as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us. Then he moves down, if you see in verse 8, he says, at one time you and I were darkness, at one time we were the beast, but now that we have been loved, but now that we know the bittersweet taste of grace, now we are light in the Lord. And then he says it here again, walk as children of light. Walk as though you're the prince and not the beast. No matter how hideous and ferocious and hardened our exteriors may be, all of us were made for love and light. And when that light breaks through, it brings life to the world. An entire kingdom is transformed as the beast melts away and becomes a being of light. But this is not easy. I don't want to minimize the challenge. And I often think like, well, if there was like a real sequel to Beauty and the Beast, like they actually did it, and like you kind of got to see like what marriage looks like under the happily ever after guys, like are there days where like he kind of goes back to being the beast? Probably. Like that's how real marriage works. Like, you know, I was just thinking like some days, like if they get in a fight, like do the fangs just come back? Or like, does he just get like a super hairy paw again? Or I don't know, but there's a battle, there's a struggle. It's an ongoing thing. It's not just a once and done rescue. And it makes me think of something that Jesus said during the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 7. He tells his followers and those folks that were starting to gather around him in chapter 7, verse 13, he says, you're gonna have to enter by a narrow gate. You're going to have to walk wisely. You're going to have to walk in love. You're going to have to walk as a child of light. But it is a narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the way is easy that leads to destruction. If you're the note-taking type, you may just want to make a T-chart in your notes right here. And on one side of the T-chart, you can label it foolish. Foolish, that's kind of the top part. And listen to what the foolish way looks like. The foolish way is wide. The foolish way is easy. And the foolish way leads to destruction. And many will take it. In fact, I think that the foolish way is the abundant way. There are plenty of ways to enter by the wide, easy gate that leads to destruction. Ephesians 4 and 5 are filled with the alternative path. But there's a narrow way, and if you'll label the other column wise, the wise way is narrow and hard, but it leads to life. And those who find it are few. When you just look down that T-chart and you see wide, easy, destruction, and many, and then you look over on the other side and you see narrow, hard, life, and few. Which do you choose? How do you want your days to count? Sometimes I think that we just equate hard with bad. But I think deep down we all know that hard means worth it. Deep down, I think all of us know that we're going to have to endure some hardship. We're going to have to endure some struggles. It's going to be a daily battle to maintain our identity as a child of light and not become a beast. If we're going to be imitators of God, if we're going to walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, it's going to be costly. It's going to be hard, but it will be worth it, because the narrow and hard way leads to life, whereas all the wide and easy ways lead to death. For some reason, most of us choose easy and destruction instead of choosing hard in life. And here's what I think is kind of behind that. The depth of our belovedness determines the width of our reach. The deeper you are loved, the wider you can reach. Those who are loved little, love little. But those who are loved much, love much. The depth of our belovedness determines the width of our reach. It's why we've been hitting on grace so much this weekend. Because those of us who are loved deeply are able to reach widely. I love Bob Goff wrote a book. It's funny. He tells a story early on in the book. This one is called Everybody Always. And his first book was called Love Does. And I love Bob Goff. He's just a super exciting, exuberant, abundant life type guy. And he says, usually your second book stinks. But in the foreword of the book, he talks about how he had left a computer in a van while they were serving some homeless people in San Francisco, and somebody had broken the windows of the van and stole his laptop, and he hadn't saved the manuscript of his second book into the cloud. And so he's like, so some homeless person stole my sucky second book. This is actually my third book, Everybody Always. Everybody Always. Jesus left the apostles that night with a new command to love everybody always. And if I were writing a book about the width or the reach of my love, I would call it Easy People Sometimes. Because that's who I love. I love the easy people sometimes. And it reminds me that I am deeply, deeply, deeply in need of grace. But if we're going to walk this narrow road, if we're going to walk wisely, if we're going to walk the hard way that leads to life, we're going to have to see again and again and again and again and again and again just how loved we are. And as that message permeates our soul, as it is drilled deep into our hearts, as we are rooted and grounded in love and have strength to comprehend with all the saints, all the dimensions of that love, to know a love that surpasses knowledge, we will begin to dream about the abundantly more glorious dreams that God has. And we will walk in a manner worthy of the gospel. And I could walk you through Ephesians 4, 17 through 20, chapter 5, verse 21, and show you all the different ways this love looks. But I'd love to just kind of tell you the end of Bob's book, if I can. Instead of walking through each of those things, I'd like to just kind of cover the last six chapters with you of Everybody Always. So if you're reading it and you're only halfway through, spoiler alert, Ben Miller. Spoiler alert, last six chapters all have to do with the work that Bob and the organization Love Does is doing in Uganda. And if you know kind of Bob's story, he's a lawyer, he taught at Pepperdine, he's kind of got his whole background is in law, but he sold his practice and now he just runs this non-for-profit organization called Love Does, and the majority of what they do is work with the most at-risk kids around the world. One of the countries that they work in is Uganda. This is what happens when a God-sized dream is implanted in your heart. They work with some of the most vulnerable kids in Uganda. And Bob was on a trip. He came into the country, and this was before Love Does. This was before the whole kind of work with all the kids had started. And he was there because a family member had told him, hey, you need to go check some stuff out in Uganda. He walks up, he goes into this, he's like, this place, it's like an office or whatever. It looked important. It was covered, armed guards, AKs, barbed wire, the whole thing. He gets in and he walks by the receptionist and she's like, oh, are you here for so-and-so? And he's like, yeah, sure, why not? And so he goes into this office, he's sitting down. He ends up finding out later that he had walked into the equivalent of their Supreme Court justice's office in Uganda. And he just kind of found himself there. And he was talking to this guy about some of the legal ramifications of things that were happening in country. And he just kind of thought, wow, that must be it. But he heard, there was a problem that was occurring regularly in Uganda. And it was with regards to witch doctors. And it intrigued Bob, so he started to ask questions about it. And what they found is that the practice of child sacrifice is still very much alive and active in Uganda. And what often happens is these witch doctors will mutilate children, believing that their parts are somehow pleasing to the gods. And after these mutilation rituals, the children are often just left to die. And this Supreme Court, equivalent judge is telling this to Bob. And Bob looks at him and he says, if ever a child survives, you let me know. And so Bob goes back to the States. He's going about his business. His life is unfolding as it unfolds. And eventually he gets a call. and he can't make out the number. He answers the call, and you know, Bob is kind of a shyster and a prankster, and so he's like, it must be one of my friends playing a prank. But no, it was the judge from Uganda. He said, someone survived. This kid's name is Charlie. He's been mutilated and was left for dead, but he's alive, and he's willing to testify if you'll take the case. And so Bob gets on a plane, he flies back to Uganda, and he begins to get to know Charlie. He begins to get to know Charlie's story. He begins to develop a relationship with Charlie. He's loving everybody always. And he goes to court, and he says, he gets into the court, and the lineup of just, you know, shady characters, Charlie, brave little Charlie, picks out the witch doctor who mutilated his body and attempted to kill him. He calls him out, points to him. They go into trial, and Charlie is sitting in the trial with the man who tried to kill him and offer him as a sacrifice. And he courageously tells his story. He testifies. And Bob says, this man's name was Kabi, the witch doctor. He said, Kabi is pure evil. He is a child of darkness. He worships the prince of the power of this air. He would be all of the alternative path and more. And he says, looking at Kabi is like looking at pure evil. Looking into his eyes sends chills down your spine. But Charlie, little Charlie, stood toe-to-toe with this witch doctor throughout the entire trial. And the judge finally at the end is able to declare Kabi guilty. And justice, for the first time in Ugandan history, is served. A witch doctor is punished for breaking the law and mutilating a child. And Bob ends up adopting Charlie. And Charlie becomes part of his family. And over time, the story starts to spread. The first ever conviction of a witch doctor in Uganda. It kind of becomes national news. There's someone who's willing to stand up and advocate for justice and for good in this broken and hideous world. And so all of a sudden, more and more cases start coming. More and more witch doctors are being held accountable for their action. And Bob and a team of lawyers are fighting these things. But all the while, stateside, all of a sudden, there's a phone call that comes from a plastic surgeon. He says, hey, I heard what happened to Charlie. I can fix him. And Bob's like, I have no idea how that works. But this guy is like one of five people in the country that can do this sort of thing. And after a, you know, he says, I took Charlie to Disney World because when someone's going to have that operation, the next day they need to go to Disney World. And the next day, Charlie sat courageously again as he went through a procedure that is utterly unique, performed by one of a handful of people in the world that can probably perform it. And it does restore dignity to his body. It brings back a piece of what was lost. It's yet another way in which glory breaks through into a broken world. And Charlie's body is restored. And Bob says, but something weird started to happen to me as the concept of loving everybody always and serving a God who is rich in mercy, who is an abundantly gracious God, something started stirring in his soul, and he hated the thought of it. But he began to realize that loving everybody always didn't just mean loving Charlie. That's who it makes sense to love. Loving everybody always also means loving Kabi. And Bob fought it because it's so much simpler to love easy people sometimes. So much easier to love an 8-year-old boy who's been mutilated by a witch doctor and served one of life's greatest injustices. Much, much, much more difficult to be an imitator of God and to walk in love and to offer forgiveness to the man who did it. And Bob said he went back to Uganda. He went into a prison that was really built for about 200 prisoners that was housing somewhere in the vicinity of 5,000 prisoners. And he met with Kabi. And he says as he walked in, he said his eyes still permeated, sent chills down his spine because he still saw in this man a great evil, but something had changed in that time in prison. And he says, Kabi fell to his knees. And he said, I know that I am going to die in here. I know that I am going to die in here. But I need to be forgiven for what I've done. Because no matter how hideous our lives look, there is a beacon of light buried beneath the beast, dying to get out. And people are waiting for someone to break through with a love that drills through the beastliness and into the beauty within us and calls it back out of us. And Bob leads Cobby to Christ. And over time, he says he's made many visits now back and forth. He's talked with Bob. There comes a day where Bob goes back to Uganda and Cobby is he's preaching a sermon to the prison. They're leading a revival of sorts within the prison. And Cobby is up front and he's sharing the forgiveness that is offered to him in Christ. And all of these people are coming to faith and Cobby's got a water bottle and he's baptizing people as they come forward. And Bob's like, I don't even think that's how you do that, but that's fine, whatever. You know, it's not about theology at this point. It's about forgiveness and grace and love that changes the human heart. And it's about light breaking through the darkness. And Bob says in that moment, Cobby, the evil witch doctor who was his enemy, looks at him, looks at Bob Goff, the lawyer from America who liberated the child and has restored him as an adopted son in his household. Cobby looks at Bob and says, I forgive you. In that moment, Bob says, I was wrecked. Why did I need to be forgiven? And the truth of it is, if you and I forget our deep need of grace, we will never be able to love everybody always. You cannot love everybody always if you think you're above people most of the time. And if you lose sight of how we are graciously destined and designed for a glorious good, if you get too focused on just the glorious good and just the walk, and you forget the love that inspires that walk, what the heck are you doing? It is not the new command that Jesus built the church around, to love one another as he has loved us. Cobby looked at Bob and loved him as an enemy, just like Bob had looked at Cobby years before and loved him as an enemy. That is the gospel in motion. So let's just take a minute. And something that Mark Batterson talks a lot about is retracing the miracle. All of this story, so many different miraculous acts of love, so much of Ephesians 4:17 through 5:21 played out in real time in this story of Bob and Cobby and Charlie and all the people that are involved. And my question as you are choosing whether or not you're going to walk the hard and narrow path of love, whether you are going to walk wisely and walk in a manner worthy of your gospel, is whether or not the destination that you are walking toward is glorious enough to compel you forward. Can you take the next step in love, believing in the ultimate destination? If you want, that is kind of the end game. The miracle is that God is restoring all of creation and he's using us to make his appeal. But if you retrace the miracle, like Mark Batterson said, I want to just make it as simple as possible for you. Bob Goff was a lawyer who went to Uganda because a family member told him to. Everything else that transpired happened because he got a degree, he went to school, he stepped into a career, and he listened to the suggestion of somebody that he loved. It's that simple. And sometimes I think we just make it too complicated. Can you just take the simple next step in love? You don't have to figure out how to baptize witch doctors and lead prison revivals in Uganda while restoring mutilated children. You just have to take the next step in love. That's how you walk wisely. That's how you walk as a child of light. That is how you walk in love, and that is how you walk in a manner worthy of the gospel. So what's your next step?